Thank you for the introduction. I'd also like to thank Youngbek and organizers for actually accommodating my schedule. So I had an unusual actually teaching schedule, so I couldn't come and join the workshop in the first 2 days. But I'm happy to give this talk today. And then my talk is going to be entirely different from like this morning's talk. So I'm an experimentalist, and then I have very few equations in this thing, and then it'll be a lot of pictures and then sort of show and tell kind of thing. Okay, so this doesn't work. Okay, yeah. Before I want to acknowledge all the work that this is a sort of a culmination or sort of a ongoing status update on our research on the Kitaev materials, and then we actually started this work almost 10 years ago, and then over this time, I think we have collected a lot of different data and then understood, actually advanced a lot of understanding in the Kitaev materials, and I'll go through them as we go along. And the particular sort of part of the talk that I'm sort of going to focus on, it was done recently by my postdoc, Blair Libert, and then the other my previous students actually have contributed over the years, and then the data that I'm going to focus on today, it was obtained in Diamond the Light Source in UK. So, and then some of the data that I'm going to show you were obtained in the Argonne Lab and then Brookhaven Lab using a synchrotron. Okay, so the outline of the talk looks like this. So it's sort of more or less a two-part talk. So I'm going to give a brief introduction about many different things, because I'm assuming that some of the audience members are not familiar with this, and then so I think maybe actually not familiar with this type of experimental talk. So I'm going to sort of give a brief introduction about the Kitaev model, which actually is the part probably many people are familiar with, and then sort of how to realize Kitaev model and then end up with the Kitaev materials, and then also give a brief introduction to an experimental technique called the RICS. And then I'll give a sort of more or less brief, very status update on alpha ruthenium chloride. And then the second part is about the RICS results, and then I'm going to compare RICS results in different materials and then discuss some of the common features. So Kitaev model is something now it's a very famous, and so I'm going to sort of go through this really briefly. So Kitaev model is a spin model on a honeycomb lattice, and the important thing about this thing is that the interaction is bond dependent. So spatial anisotropy is encoded in the model. So you have a red, blue, and green bonds have actually different sort of a number that's acting on different components of the spin. And that actually sort of gives you an exactly solvable model. It was exactly solved by Kitaev in the original paper. And then the important part about this is that there is a low energy degrees of freedom of Majorana fermions, and then also ground state is quantum spin liquid. And obviously, it is drawing a lot of attention, so because one of the ground state quantum spin liquid phase has a non-abelian anions and useful for quantum topological quantum computing. So, and then over the years, there has been a lot of review papers on this, both theoretically and experimentally. So for those of people who are interested, there are some of these review papers. Okay, so that is theory, and that's basically end of the theory. And now let's actually talk about how to realize this in real materials, and then that's where famously called the Jacquelli-Kalulin mechanism comes in. So to realize this Kitaev model in real model system, real materials, you need at least two components. One is your spin cannot be just a simple spin, spin angular momentum. So you actually have to have some kind of spatial component, meaning that orbital has to be sort of mixed in. So one example that was proposed by Jacquelli-Kalulin was that if you introduce an iridium 4+ ion with 5d electrons into an octahedral environment, then you first split this level between because of the octahedral crystal field, you actually split this and then leave this system in the lower spin state, and then spin orbit coupling actually sort of makes this the spin degrees or effective spin degrees of freedom to be a so-called J effective equal half, which is another way of saying it's a Kramer's doublet with orbital sort of information encoded into this. And the wave function looks like this, so there is orbital information. The second component that is important for realizing Hittite materially is that it has to be now on the edge shared octahedral network. So if you sort of connect this octahedra, so this is sort of a unit spin, and then connect this by sort of connecting this through so-called edge sharing geometry, what happens is that the more dominant super exchange interaction through this oxygen between iridium, oxygen, iridium, which is 90 degrees bond, will basically cancel between the top and bottom point and the path. And that means that dominant, so usually dominant higher sort of dominant sort of the exchange interaction, which is usually J, is suppressed, and then you have a next dominant term, a Kitaev interaction becomes important. And that sort of kind of proposes a recipe for building a Kitaev material, which is basically taking an iridium oxygen octahedra and connect them in this sharing sharing network. And the end result is this, and this is called the first actually example of Kitaev material with the sodium iridium oxide. So there are sort of sodium ions interdispersed in this network, but the main thing here is that this is edge shared iridium oxide octahedral network. So that is the introduction to Kitaev material. Now, I'm sort of switching gear and then talk about the experimental technique of resonant inelastic X-ray scattering. And some of you may be familiar with the inelastic neutron scattering, which is a sort of more powerful, more or less powerful experimental technique, spectroscopy technique that is used by a lot of people studying spin models and so on. So in the last sort of 10 or more years, the resonant inelastic scattering has actually come along a long way, and then now I think it's used, so almost like used as a very, very powerful complementary technique for inelastic neutron scattering. So that's why I'm sort of kind of trying to introduce this interesting technique. So in the end, this is a scattering technique, meaning that you are looking at the energy and momentum transfer to the system and trying to see actually what kind of elementary excitations that you can actually excite using this kind of technique. So this is a sort of a very schematic view of instant X-ray and outgoing X-ray sort of giving the momentum and energy transfers. But the sort of kind of complicating thing about RICS is, and the reason why it's called resonant inelastic is because it goes through so-called intermediate state, which it has a core hole in this atom that we are interested in. And this is has a very short lifetime. So in some sort of generally, it in approximation, you can basically ignore this and sort of write down some of the Hamilton sort of equations. So this is a sort of equation that describes the cross-section or RICS intensity. And then it is Kramer's Heisenberg interaction, the equation that actually tells you. So this is basically telling you that it is measuring some kind of excitation energy, and the excitation energy has energy, intensity has energy denominator that actually makes it enhanced at certain instant energy. So that is what makes this powerful technique. And it turns out the benefit of doing RICS is that it is coupling to pretty much everything there is in terms of elementary excitation. So obviously it will be coupling to charge excitation or orbital excitations, but it is now well established that it can couple to magnons, bimagnons, or like multiple magnons. And then phonons obviously is another thing that is very strongly coupled to. And then you can sort of tune your sort of the experimental condition to accentuate a certain type of phonons. And for those of you who are familiar with the neutron scattering, these two actually are sort of good examples which actually illustrates power of a resonant inelastic X-ray scattering or RICS. So first example here is the magnon dispersion relation measured in strontium iridium oxide. This is a square lattice magnet. So this is as simple of a sort of model magnetic system that you can find. And if you just write down, sort of solve a sort of harmonic spin wave Hamiltonian and then solve it, then you have a spin wave dispersion that looks like this. And also, importantly, you can actually get intensity information from the just this completely simple Hossein-Primakov type of calculation, get intensity that diverges near the zone center, magnetic zone center, and then disappears at the magnetic the structural zone center. And this intensity of magnon dispersion, so this is exactly what you expect for inelastic neutron scattering. So that is sort of is a very great actually comfort for experimentalists to say that the RIX is kind of like inelastic neutron scattering. The another thing that is actually very interesting and then is a very appropriate in this audience is that this is a spin chain. And we know the spin chain, the elementary excitation, is not a magnon, it is spinon. And in a scattering experiment, you are creating two spinons at the same time. And this has been shown a long time ago that inelastic neutron scattering shows that this characteristic continuum of two spinon continuum of a spin chain. And in using RIX, you can see exactly that. And then sort of this is, showing you that RIX can be coupling to different types of elementary excitations. The instrumentation, maybe actually many of you are not familiar with interested in this, but I'm just showing you that some of the instrumentation requirement is quite actually massive. So here, this is the latest experiment that we have carried out at this beamline, and then basically the instrument is, if you imagine some kind of basketball court, this is basically the size of that instrument, and then this is about 10 meters around here. So the reason is simply because if you want to get better and better energy resolution to resolve elementary excitations, you basically have to have a longer and longer distance to obtain the higher energy resolution or angular resolution for given grading spacing. So that's actually the reason why you are doing that. Anyway, so what can we do for Kitaev materials? So I sort of showed you that the Kitaev materials are described by this valence, the electron states. So you have a J effective half state and J effective 3/2 state, and with the 5 electrons, you have one hole in J effective half. And this is the ground state. And then, as I said, the RIX is a second order process. You are actually creating excitation from and creating a core hole in the 2p, and then putting an electron up there, and then a different electron can fall down, and then you are virtually making excitation from this ground state to this excited state. And it turns out that the energy difference between these two states is just determined by the spin orbit coupling. And so in real materials, it is usually there is some additional small trigonal field, meaning that if you have an octahedral sort of network of honeycomb lattice, and then if you have some kind of squeezing sort of down, then you can actually have a trigonal distortion. So that splits this. So with that sort of background, this is the RIX result. So this is sort of data obtained many years ago, showing you that what we are seeing is basically the splitting between these B and C, which is a splitting between this, and the energy scale that we are basically looking at, this 0.75, is the overall the energy scale of a spin orbit coupling. So we have basically observing these two things. So that's basically great. And then at the time, there was something else at a lower energy. And then we didn't really pay too much attention to this. And you sort of from this, you can sort of see that there is some kind of continuum. This is a particle hole continuum in your normal insulator. And then you have some excitation at the end of the edge of the particle hole continuum. So it is kind of nice to, or sort of reasonable to assume that this is some kind of exciton formed by particle hole continuum. So that's basically what we knew about at the time. And then I'll come back to that later. So what can you do more about the with RICs? You can actually probe magnetic excitations, and then if you go down and down and down to really low energy scale to look at the magnetic excitations, you will see something like this for lithium iridium oxide. And then this is the data from sodium iridium oxide by another group. And you can sort of see that there is some kind of maybe dispersing magnetic excitations. But the main message here I'm going to tell you is that the energy resolution is not good enough to actually see any fine details about the magnetic excitations. So that's actually a limitation of RICs at the moment. So let's switch gear again. So that's where ruthenium chloride or alpha ruthenium trichloride comes in, because iridate is not great for neutron scattering. It turns out that iridate is possibly the worst material you can think of for neutron scattering. So it is basically impossible to do any neutron scattering work on iridates, so meaning that you cannot measure any magnetic excitation spectrum or anything like that on an iridate. So what about other materials? So the ruthenium is 4D elements, but you can also find the material which actually forms exactly the honeycomb lattice that looks like this, which is basically the same thing prescribed by Jacquard-Kalulin mechanism. And it has a ruthenium, so that means that you can do neutron scattering. So this is a a better alternative for an experimentalist. And so we actually studied this material, and then the question initially was that, is actually spin-orbit coupling strong enough to make this system into a J-effective half system? And the answer is that yes, it is, and then without going into the detailed X-ray absorption spectroscopy tells us that it is. And of course, in the last perhaps a decade, one of the most exciting actual results that came out of studying alpha-ruthenium chloride is this discovery or report of quantized the thermal Hall effect by Yuji Matsuda's group about 3 or 4 years. Yes? Simply because neutron has a very large absorption cross-section. So all the neutrons coming in, sort of iridium nuclei basically eats up. So nothing really is scattered off of spins. So that's a sort of rough answer to that. And many cases, you can actually avoid that problem by using different isotope. But iridium actually is one of those things which doesn't have isotopes. So that's why I think that's the problem, okay? All right, so going back to this. Yeah, so taking one step back, ruthenium chloride is actually not a quantum spin liquid. It's a ground state in ambient field and ambient temperature, obviously, and because it actually orders magnetically. So the ground state of a ruthenium chloride in zero field is a magnetic order state. So you need to actually kill this magnetic order to get to any phase of a quantum spin liquid, but you can apply magnetic field to achieve that. And what these authors found was when you go to this regime where the magnetic order is killed by a magnetic field, you can actually find that a thermal Hall effect, right? So this is an insulator, very good insulator, so you cannot see any electrical Hall effect. So you can actually look for thermal Hall effect, and they found that thermal Hall effect is quantized at the half integer level. That is a sort of a smoking gun evidence for having Majorana sort of fractional excitation in this system, and as expected for a quantum spin liquid ground state. This is great, and then this actually spurred a lot of interest in this material. But so there was some controversy about this because there are sort of three subsequent reports on the same material which actually give some mixed message about the observation of a thermal quantum Hall effect. So, and these are all from very respected groups. So Fuan Ong's group and then Louis Taillefer's group reported that they could not observe the thermal Hall quantization effect. And then Hidetakagi group reported that they actually could observe this thing. So what's going on here? The current estimation or sort of understanding is that it is a sample dependence. So it turns out that this sample and also the original group, the report sample, is basically the same sample. And this group and this group used the same type of samples. And even for actually for the same basically samples coming from the same sort of group method or same growth method, they show very different actually values, right? So the absolute values for thermal hole conductivity for five different samples all show very different things. And so I think there is a still uncertainty, and maybe actually with the improvement or better quality samples, maybe actually these groups will be able to observe this. So I think the jury is still out there. So here, so I'm just trying to say that the best looking sample here is grown by our group. So so what's actually happening? So we actually made a little bit of a better understanding of what's happening in the sample, because it looks like the sample at room temperature might be all pretty much the same. But what's important and then the sort of a crucial information about the alpha ruthenium chloride is that as you go down in temperature, it goes through the structural phase transition. So that means, I mean, so this is a kind of difficult to make out, but at 200K and then 20K, the diffraction pattern basically switches peak position. So there is actually structure change. But when it happens, so that's sort of kind of, this is a high temperature structure. And as you go to lower temperature, basically there is a stacking pattern changes. So here, stacking pattern is along the A direction at room temperature. But as you go to lower temperature, this scanning pattern sort of switches to a stacking sort of a displacement along the B direction. And it turns out that you can have either plus B or minus B, meaning that you can have a twinning that actually is different for different samples. So I think that might be the leading to the cause of the different actual results. So it is very difficult to actually identify whether or not you have a good sample to start with in at room temperature. That is a very long introduction part. So I'm going to switch gear to talk about what's new, okay? So Kitaev materials, so this is a sort of current status of a list of a sort of more prominent Kitaev materials. So this is a kind of first generation sodium iridium oxide, lithium iridium oxide. It turns out that you can actually make a network of different types of lithium iridium oxide. So it's a beta and gamma phase of a lithium iridium oxide. And then also we talked about alpha ruthenium chloride. And then more recently, led by Hidetakagi group, that you can actually take this, one of these honeycomb lattice, and sort of squeeze in some other elements like hydrogen or silver or things like that, and then make sort of a lattice expand along the C direction. So that means I think you are making this system a little bit more two-dimensional, and they reported that actually the magnetic order disappears, therefore it is very possibly a candidate for spin liquid. So let's actually compare Rick's results for different types of these Kitaev materials. So you have seen this already, and then if you do the measurements for alpha lithium iridium oxide, you have a pretty much identical Rick spectrum. So you have these two levels of a split B and C, or spin orbit excitation. And then you have something that we ascribe as exciton at low level. And then you have some continuum here. Now, Ken Plum's group actually studied the new generation of Kitaev material, sodium intercalated lithium iridium oxide. And their result is actually quite different. So they see these sort of features, and then they have these peak and this peak and this peak and this peak and this peak. So it's not quite the same, and also the splitting between these two is much larger. So they were actually possible to explain this using so-called delocalized picture, where the electrons are sort of more sort of hopping freely within actually the the honeycomb, actually a benzene ring type of thing. And for those of you who are familiar with this, this was actually the picture proposed many years ago as something called quasi-molecular orbitals. So in other words, in these systems, at least in this silver case, it looks like it is further away from the idealized sort of a Kitaev physics or J effective half state. So that's actually kind of interesting because there is a subtle difference between different type of systems depending on what the crystal parameters are. So then the next sort of really interesting question is, what about ruthenium chloride? And all your work on ruthenium chloride looks like this. So this is Rick's scan, and this is just a line scan through this line here. So if you just take this line, and it's kind of like this, you have something like this. And this is a work done by us, and then this is another work done by Bernhard Keimer's group. And the main thing here is that you see this energy scale of a spin orbit coupling, and that is something that you are expecting, but you couldn't actually see much of a fine sort of details. However, more recent data with higher resolution that obtained by us, so you can sort of clearly see that there are fine structures within ruthenium chloride Rick's data. So, and this is actually very surprising because, so actually let's take, so this is, you can see the fine structure, and then what's important here is that it's strikingly similar to the spectrum that we observed in sodium iridate and lithium iridate. And this is actually somewhat surprising because and this is basic comparison, right? So this is plotting the Rick's scan at gamma point for three materials. Alpha ruthenium chloride is this, and sodium iridate and lithium iridate. So both are iridate honeycomb lattice, and this is ruthenium chloride. And you sort of see that there's a strong peak here, and then there's a shoulder on the lower energy, sort of kind of the qualitatively very similar. What is very surprising to me is that the charge gap for ruthenium chloride is much, much larger than anything that's happening here, right? So remember when we were actually discussing or showing the data for these things, the charge gap of these materials are here, basically. So it was actually kind of reasonable to assume that this is the associated with some kind of charge excitation, but ruthenium chloride results tells us that whatever's happening here cannot be charge-related because charge degrees of freedom is completely quenched here. So what is it? That is actually the main question that we are asking. And first thing that you can basically see is that when I say they look similar, you might say that, oh, they have completely different actually peak positions. But that is actually misleading because remember that ruthenium and iridium has about factor of three difference in spin orbit coupling. So you can actually plot these things scaling by the spin orbit coupling, and this is basically E over lambda plot, and then you can now see that it is really qualitatively very, very similar. We had to use a slightly different lambda for lithium and sodium iridates, but let's not worry about that for now. But so mainly, so you have this sort of kind of this excitation that we expect from the spin orbit coupling, but there is an additional peak here, which is basically a kind of looks really similar, and that basically makes us think that the origin of these peaks should be the same. I mean, okay, so it's not a rigorous statement, but as a sort of experimentalist with some intuition that they should be the same. And what are they? And then it turns out that this was actually observed in theoretical calculation. So Bum-hyun Kim and co-workers some years ago did a cluster calculation of a three-band Hubbard model and then calculated the Rick's spectrum of their results. And this is basically what they have observed, is that you have the sort of very strong peak that is associated with the spin orbit excitation, and then there's a shoulder feature at lower energy. And they actually were able to say that this shoulder feature is coming from this kind of process. So remember, this kind of on-site excitation or spin orbit excitation is basically main reason you have this strong peak here. But inter-site type of excitation is actually responsible for this. And that actually is pretty clear if you look at comparison between one-site calculation and six-site calculation. So one-site calculation, you don't actually have any of these shoulder feature, but with six-site, you have this feature. And another way to sort of think about or describe this is that this is a holon double unbound state because you actually have this process means that you have a doublon and holon. And remember that because of Jacquard-Coulomb mechanism, when we talked about this, we said that there is the direct super exchange is blocked. And in other words, direct hopping between this J effective to J effective site, this is actually blocked. So this is not your normal holon doublon pair. It is actually some weird type of actually excited state holon doublon pair. And so again, this is a somewhat of actually a kind of a speculative at the moment, but that seems like what's happening. But the main thing here is that this excitation A cannot be happening in local picture only. So we basically have to take into non-local effect in describing basically all the Kitaev materials. So that's something that I think we found and that is, I think, important and perhaps actually that is going to make an impact and in sort of a deriving effective Hamiltonian for low energy physics. So let me flash this as a conclusion. So spin orbit exciton in Kitaev materials have been studied with the RICS, and then we studied these three materials, and then we found that these characteristic three peak features with the low energy excitation in addition to this high energy excitations. The energy scale is more or less determined by spin orbit coupling only, but it can be captured with, and then also it can be captured with the exact diagonalization calculation of a three-band model. And then so our focus, this the low energy A peak is not electron hole exciton as we have seen. So it cannot be associated with the charge gap of ruthenium chloride. And A peak is due to non-local physics. So and sort of current sort of candidate is holon doublon excitation. So I think I'm going to stop here and then answer questions.
All right, so now this talk is open to questions, comments. So where is electron hole exciton in this picture? If this is not the electron hole exciton, I mean sort of inter-site, I guess you could say. Yeah. So that's terribly like very high energy in alpha ruthenium chloride 3.
Right, so the gap is about one electron volt. Yeah.
But for the iridate, you said the charge gap is.
Yeah, iridate case, the charge gap is around here.
Yeah, so does it mean that you can have both?
Yes, it can have both.
Right?
Yeah.
You can have both.
But electron hole exciton alone cannot explain all three things together. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it cannot be only explanation.
Maybe
so
the intensity is very small. Muscle.
Right. Yeah. But I think the main sort of I think the most interesting result for us is that this result is showing that and I think this is extremely suggestive of the common origin of these features, and then I think that's the basic of what we were looking for is what can explain this in common language. So, but it doesn't rule out the electron hole exciton. Yeah,
I think it is consistent with the picture that in contrast to the original Jacquard-Coulomb derivation of the time model.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, in that paper, they sort of ignore the direct overlap between the orbital.
Right.
Especially like inter-site overlap. But in the real material, like that's quite large.
Right.
That's the reason why you get this large deviation from pure Gitaev model.
Right. Yeah.
So from that point of view, I think it is very natural that this sort of intersite excitation, maybe immersion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's, you know, self-consistent, I guess.
Right, so I guess the picture now, yeah, so it's like in many cases, right? So you start with a simple local picture, which is easy to understand, and but usually it is, and but it is not completely the sort of DFT sort of claim of quasi-molecular. It is somewhere in between, like many things, and but I think we are seeing some of more of evidence that actually is suggesting that the this non-local physics is important for describing all these key-type materials. And then in the end, I guess all these key-type materials are not great key-type model to end with it. So there are other terms that's important. Yeah, right.
Well, on the other hand, perhaps if you can find a material where you can get rid of it, maybe I'm just speculating.
Right? Yeah, 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 yeah.
That means
right.
The system is closer to the pure
guitar. Right, right, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I think that like further, like bigger lattice parameter and things like that,
so
right?
You can ignore those.
Yeah.
Okay, so is there any other question? Okay, maybe everybody's hungry. So if there's no other question, I'd like to thank the speaker.
Thank you.